call the Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:34 on Friday, the, what day are we today? The
21st.
21st.
Day, all day, I think.
Yeah, tomorrow we start the 29th day before the legislature is supposed to gavel out. So that'll help me remember it, right? We'll start counting down by days. With us is Senator Dyson and Senator Wilkowski and Chairman Coghill. We have a couple of members who will be coming in a little bit later. Today, on the agenda, we'll do two confirmation hearings. This is your opportunity to ask questions of a couple of appointees. We'll take up House Bill 292, which is a revisor's bill. We'll let the revisor statutes come before us. And Senate Bill 170, which is Senator Gardner's bill that we looked at last time. We'll get some public testimony on a portion of that. And then we'll take up 176, Senate Bill 176, which my staff have been working on, which is firearms on campus. And I think I have four people here to testify, and I wanted to give them opportunity to do that. So with that, we have Commission on Judicial Conduct appointee, Mark June. And Mark, are you online?
Yes, I am, sir.
So thank you for coming to our committee today, and why don't you just put yourself on record and give us a brief description of why this particular council or commission, I'm sorry, is something you'd like to do, your history, and maybe a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. The Commission on Judicial Conduct is an important commission. It is the oversight commission as to the conduct of the members of the judiciary. I appreciate that it down there in Juneau, one of the topics of conversation right now is the selection of the judiciary. But once selected, the Commission on Judicial Conduct is the body that addresses complaints about the actions of the judges and ensures that we continue to have a strong and ethical judiciary. And I take my responsibilities on the commission seriously, and I look forward to working with them on ongoing issues. As for myself, I came up here in 1980. I've been a lawyer now for 30-plus years. I've had a varied practice. Currently, my practice focuses on what's called a personal injury practice, that is the representation of accident victims. I've done quite a bit of volunteer work through the Bar Association. At one time, I was a member of the Board of Governors. I'm also on the Ethics Committee. I'm also on the Fee Arbitration Panel. I'm also on the Board of Alaska Legal Services. And I think that service on the Commission on Judicial Conduct is just another aspect of public service that we expect all our citizens to do.
Well, for me, Mark, first of all, thank you for being active in Alaska's law world, obviously pretty well qualified. Just from my perspective, the ethics code that we've had here in the legislature and the administration have been pretty well talked about. We're probably a little more public. What are some of the things that that we should know about that ethics law that maybe might be unique to just the judiciary? Can you give us any ideas on that?
Sure. There is a canon on judicial conduct that lays out the rules, if you will, that judges are supposed to follow. But I think that the most prominent thing over the last few years was there was an instance in Bethel of one particular judge deciding that it would be helpful if the prosecutor addressed certain legal authorities because the judge felt that that might be helpful to his decision. The problem with that is when judges speak, they're not supposed to speak to only one side. They're supposed to speak to two sides, and that's what you call the ex parte communication. And with respect to that particular judge, and it's a matter of public record, he'd had more than one instance of that, and the commission acted appropriately and suspended him as judge.
Yeah.
Or actually recommended suspension, and the suspension was imposed by the Alaska Supreme Court.
That reminds me of a story my wife told me after teaching one day. She came back, and she said she caught one of her students giving answers to another student, and she said, well, that's cheating. And he said, well, no, I was just trying to help her out. And so
and I guess the message is if you're a judge, you're not supposed to help just one. You're supposed to help all.
Right. Is there any questions for Mark at this point? Senator Dyson has a question, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for being willing to serve, and you do have an impressive resume. In my nearly, 50 years in the state, I don't remember many cases of judges, quote, being on the take, being bribed in one way or another. Have we had any famous or infamous cases?
I don't think I can answer that question as phrased. I can't remember off the top of my head a judge that has been accused of bribery or receiving some sort of side benefit for his decisions. There is a strict conflict of interest canon, and judges have to decide whether to recuse themselves. And there is a system in place for that, sir.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I had another great question. I think it's slipping away from me. When we have elections, in essence, to retain a judge, what are the restrictions on what a judge or his supporters can do for advocating for that retention? And where does that, can that get out into ethical issues?
It can. I know that there is one ethical issue that rises ever so often is to whether a candidate for public office can refer to the fact that he either is a judge or has been a judge in the past. With respect to retention elections of sitting judges, quite frankly, I don't know the applicable rules, and I'd be hesitant to give you a comment that later proved to be wrong.
That's fine. It was just for my interest. And
yeah,
thanks again.
I have had the experience where judges running for retention have had to scramble at the last minute because there has been public political advertising, if you will, that was urging non-retention, and they had a limited window and a limited financial ability to respond if they disagreed with what the statements were. I mean, I have seen that from a personal level on a handful of occasions over the last 10 years.
Yeah, so have I. Thank you, sir.
And Mark,
you're welcome, sir.
Just for the those who listen in on us, how does the commission actually get a challenge to a judge on their conduct? Is that something that comes from the Bar Association, from a – I could just see where a client to a lawyer might be very dissatisfied with a judge. What is the way that it comes in that it's credible?
The anyone can make a complaint about a judge. It is not restricted to lawyers. It's not restricted to federal judges. But any member of the public can make a complaint about a judge. It goes through an intake process to determine whether it falls into under the commission's jurisdiction and whether it rises to the level of requiring further investigation. I do have to tell you that oftentimes a party that appears before a judge and disagrees with the judge's ruling will make a complaint, and upon investigation, it will be determined that the judge acted properly but decided against that party. The fact that a judge has decided against a party is not grounds for sanction, and those complaints are dismissed. Otherwise, there'd be a complaint out of every proceeding because there's always winners and losers in every judicial decision.
Can greatly imagine that. So last time we were here, we had another group come before us, Police Standards Council, and it was told us that the executive director is kind of the one that is the kind of the the gatekeeper of how a question on integrity came before him. How does that go to the commission as far as before the full commission?
At each commission meeting, the executive director gives a report as to the complaints that have been received in their disposition, and if there's questions as to the whether the disposition was proper or not, the commission as a whole addresses that.
Very nice.
In other words, the executive director, the executive director does not act unsupervised.
Okay. And those are all the questions I had, because I just wanted the public to hear, because your particular world is one that is buried deep within the kind of bureaucratic system of the world, and this is the one opportunity to get it out in the open, and greatly appreciate your willingness to serve, Mark.
Thank you, and I would just add that we have a judiciary that as a state we can be proud of them.
We've agreed with that. Every once in a while, we're willing to challenge some things about the way it works, but greatly appreciate your time. Just for information, Senator McGuire has now joined us. Very busy place here this week, and so thank you for showing up. Mark, if there's no other comments, questions, thank you very much for coming on teleconference, and I'm going to, after we hear Bill Granger, I'm going to make a motion to pass your appointment onto the full body for the recommendation. Oh, I'm sorry. We have Senator McGuire ask a question.
Thank you. I just want to say hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
All right.
Good. I hope the weather down there is as good as it is up here today.
Beautiful, sunshiny day, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll be hanging up now. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mark. Have a pleasant weekend. Next, we'll go to Bill Granger in Anchorage. He's up for the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association as an appointee. Do you go by Bill or William?
Oh, Bill would be fine. Thank you.
Bill, why don't you go ahead and put yourself on the record, explain your time with the Board of Governors and a little bit about yourself and what you expect to be able to do as an appointee to the Board of Governors.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. Yes, my name is William Granger. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've been employed in the banking industry for about 37 years, starting out in high school at a little place called Matanuska Valley Bank. Most of my tenure has been with National Bank of Alaska and Wells Fargo Bank, serving in the last 15 years or so as a senior credit officer in both institutions. I have, in that role as a banker, had a lot of involvement and activity with the legal community, lawyers and courts and arbitrators and legislators, and have always kind of enjoyed that interaction and ability to influence and gain a greater understanding of how the process works and what it does. I think this will be my potentially fourth appointment to the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association. And if the executive director is correct, it would be the longest public member of the Board of Governors. And I think that gives me a rather unique perspective in that the Bar Association's administrative staff is extremely tenured, and I don't mean that from a derogatory standpoint at all. But the Board of Governors generally rotates in and out on a three-year basis, and you don't get to see a lot of history from an institutional standpoint in those 3 years. Quite frankly, it takes a board member at least a year to understand what's going on, another year to maybe start feeling comfortable, and only in their third year do they actually get to be in a position of being a greater influence than they would had been previously. And so a lot of the guidance as to the decisions that they make comes from the current executive staff of the Bar Association. It doesn't come from within the Board of Governors itself. So my tenure with them, I think, gives me a unique ability to offer institutional history from someone other than the staff. Also, my training and background as a banker allows me to offer to them some financial management types of abilities. And, you know, I do that by currently serving as treasurer, for example, a role which I've served several times, helping with them in managing their budget and the line items in there, you know, whether that be on the expense side or the revenue side, trying to keep the boat on a nice even keel so we don't have roller coaster up and downs and dues and various expenses to that balance sheet, if you will. So it is an important function of Board of Governors in the state of Alaska. We have a lot of attorneys, as I'm sure you very well know, and thank God most of them are excellent people. You know, every once in a while we run across one that falters some, and it's our job to analyze that and determine whether it is of merit to look at farther, to investigate it, to recommend courses of action to the Supreme Court to take to hopefully correct or change the behavior that happened with those attorneys. But one of the most important things to me is the public service that the Bar Association offers to the general public. From simple things like recommendations for lawyers, you know, lawyers will register with us their expertise in various areas, and we will share that knowledge with the general public. Offering legal services to our less fortunate population through things like our activities during Martin Luther King Day, etc. A lot of continuing education, including ethics, with our Bar Association members. So the public service part of it is important to me, as well as the professional challenges being associated with such a group and the financial aspect of it. I hope that answers your question.
Bill, thank you very much. I think that was a very good explanation. First of all, I'm going to open up to the committee if there's any question or comments for Bill. Bill, one of the things that we have talked about in this committee, and you might just help me with, is in this board, you know, it's an area that many of us in the world do not understand, but one of the things you just said kind of shed a little light that you actually do some continuing education, and it looks like you work with people who are trying to represent themselves, so I'm grateful for that. What are some of the ethical issues that you deal with that, say, may be different than what the general public would expect?
Well, I had thought about the general public expectations, but, you know, it can be lawyers being out of trust on their trust accounts, lawyers not adequately representing their clients through some form of neglect, lawyers not being responsive and respectful to local bar rules. There's also some conflict and grievance aspects of this too. If a lawyer and a client have a grievance over fee arbitration types of issues that we might deal with.
That was very, that's kind of helpful, Bill. I was just kind of curious, but I have Senator Dyson who wants to get to a pointed question. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I'm wise enough to know that the plural of anecdote is not data, and that I hear anecdotally in the South Central Alaska where I live that it's pretty standard for many divorce lawyers to encourage their client to run to the courtroom and file for a domestic violence restraining order or an accusation of abuse of some sort, and often it's a foot race to get that done as just as a tactic to prejudice the divorce settlement and allocation of children and assets and so on. And it's always difficult for us who are outsiders to think of the judicial process as being kind of a trial by combat instead of really centered on truth and fairness and justice and so on. But when does a lawyer get out on the edges of ethics by making charges and presenting viewpoints that are perhaps in the client's best interest but don't deserve their cause of justice?
Well, Senator Dyson, first off, I'm not a lawyer, but in my experience, I would say that if an attorney represented a misfact to the court, knowing that that was not a factual representation, whether or not that information came through their client, it would be an ethics violation and probably something that the Bar Association would be interested in looking at. But we depend on our lawyers to represent their clients and do that in a factual, truthful way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have seen professionally clients try to encourage their lawyers to make arguments that are not supportable or truthful, and in those cases, I have seen those lawyers refuse to do that.
All right, so thank you. Thank you.
It would shock my conscience to see that happen.
All right, thank you.
Bill, thank you very much for coming before the committee. Is there any other questions? Running tight on time, I really appreciate you taking your time, Bill, both to come before the committee and to serve on the Board of Governors. We're going to make a recommendation, I think, at this point. So is there any last comments before we have you sign off?
It's my pleasure. I thank you for the recommendation.
Thank you very much. And with that, what I do is if there's no objection, I'm going to have a signature to recommend them to the body for confirmation. Is there any objection to that, Senator?
No objection, but I do just want to state, Mr. Chair, sure. I'm a member of the Alaska Bar Association.
Yeah, we like picking on members of the Alaska Bar Association here.
Me in particular.
Yes, you.
So does that require – I don't think that requires a motion. I think we just
– it does not.
I don't think it does. And so we'll just sign. Why don't we take an at ease? We'll sign that up and we'll just send them on to the. Come back on to order. We now have House Bill 292, which is the 2014 Revisor Statutes Bill. And before us, we have the Revisor Statute. Put yourself on record. Tell us what we got in front of us. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Lisa Kirsch. I'm actually the Assistant Revisor. So. Not to step too far ahead of myself. The purpose of the revisor's bill, as you may already know, is just to correct and remove any deficiencies, any conflicts, any obsolete provisions, and essentially improve the form of the statutes. Now, when we draft the legislation that you ask for, we always try to make bills correct and to make everything consistent with the drafting manual, but occasionally, there are errors and problems that creep in during the process or later. And so the bill that I have before you today is just to clean up. It's not an attempt to change the law in any way or make any changes to policy. And we invite the Attorney General's office to review the bill. They have done that, and they've indicated that they don't see any difficulties with it. To give you some of the highlights of the bill, in this particular revisor's bill, we've changed a few references to adoptive child. The term that's more often used is adopted child, and so just for consistency throughout the statutes and to conform with common usage of the terms, we've changed adoptive child to adopted child, and that occurs in a couple of different sections. There are new names for a federal bureau that was changed in recent federal law. That needed to be updated. There's a boiler code that the name of the code has changed, so we've updated that. There are several instances of the phrase, but not limited to. We have a statute at the beginning of the Alaska statutes in Title I that allows us to consider the word including to include but not limited to. So if you're saying like domesticated animals, including but not limited to cows, you don't really need the additional phrase but not limited to. It's just, you know, for conservation of words in the statute. So there's a few instances of that that we discovered that we've deleted but not limited to. There was a typo, the word stimulation in relation to stimulating oil and gas fields was changed to simulating. The T got dropped out somewhere during the process, so that we're changing back to the correct term, stimulate. And then there are other obsolete date references and inconsistencies of terms that we've corrected. So that's what we're doing this year. Obviously, we can't correct all problems in statutes. We have to stay policy neutral. We can't do anything that is controversial in the revisor's bill. So most of these are pretty uninteresting changes. They're just corrections of things that we know what they mean and not something we need to interpret. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. It's been my observation that we are the ones that are trying to correct statutes over and over and over again, so thank you very much. Section 11, the question I had.
Okay.
And I think I asked my staff this, but I can't remember the number, so you probably just have it right off the top of your head. This is a reference to a U.S. code, which I always struggle with having them by way of reference, but it is under the mental health and substance use disorder. And it must be that the U.S. code changed?
Yes. Yes.
And this, that's all that's happened there?
Yeah. That's the numbering changed. And it's still the same section, but the site changed.
So those we're just always catch my eye.
Yeah.
That we're not adopting a whole new code?
No.
All right. Is there any questions for the revisor? Senator Dyson?
Just offline, I would enjoy a visit with the director of your section. I wish that we had a function that was going and looking for obsolete laws and ones that haven't been followed and ones that are contradictory and so on. But I just enjoy having that discussion offline.
Yeah, we just had one to go across our floor today that was changed because it hadn't been followed, just been ignored until it came up in a court case.
Yeah, but with lots of things there that, yeah, some of which are pretty silly. You can still get busted if they cop finds you with something that might be a burglar tool in your trunk.
Well, I had my staff go through this, and I didn't see anything that caused me any questions. Any other questions from the committee? My intention to ask for a motion to move it. Now, Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move the revisor's bill, let's see, what is it, 292B, from committee with individual recommendations, and I suspect it's a fiscal note.
It's the O version.
O version?
Yes.
All right. Backslash O version. LS, 28LSO904/O.
Thank you. Is there objection to moving the revisor's bill from committee with individual recommendations and I think attached zero fiscal note, please? Yes.
Better.
All right.
Awesome.
Without objection, then House Bill, CS or House Bill 292 Judiciary is passed from committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take a brief at ease while we're. Back on the order. Senate's back in order. We have Senate Bill 170. Berta Gardner is here to present it. We got it presented last time. There was a couple of questions that came before us, and I think the Senator wanted to give some of her explanation to some of the questions and what she thinks should be how it should move forward. So, Senator, welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for bringing up Senate Bill 170 again. We've talked about it casually referred to it as the prostitutes bill, and I just want to take this opportunity to say, really, it's the trafficking bill.
Yes, it's true.
And I just want to be really clear about it. That is our intention, and at the same time, perhaps do some good for people who have been coerced into prostitution. But really, we want to get the big guys, the big people running it. You could arrest every prostitute on the street in Alaska today, and somebody, there'd be another crew out there before you know it. So that's our real focus. That being said, there were some questions, and in the testimony last time, there were some suggestions, some of which I find very interesting and very positive, good things to do, but that's not our intent right now. I think that we really want to go through with something that I think is uncontroversial, get it in place, maybe gather data over time, and tackle some of the other aspects of things we can do for this issue. But we'll be as quick as we can here today. We do have some answers, and I'm going to let my aide present that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate it. And for those who are listening in, I know that there's a much more comprehensive approach that I think is totally appropriate, but probably not, we've got 29 days left, right? Probably not something we're going to be able to get put together and get it put together for a passing this year. This one actually could.
Yes.
So why don't you go ahead and identify yourself and give us what you came up with as briefly as you can. Thank you.
Very well. For the record, my name is Steve Handy. I serve the office of Senator Britta Gardner, Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for allowing me to again address this bill. We'd like to thank the committee for the effort that you've put forth on SB 170. Some have been very close to sex trafficking and have offered some suggestions. You heard them last week. We acknowledge their valid concerns and that the system thus so far has failed them or forsaken them. We value and continue to investigate the points they brought up in public testimony relating to police training, charges that can be excused by affirmative defense, court view records issues, having to bear witness against the traffickers, how stressful that could be, outreach programs, and a couple more. However, to those who wish to add provisions to our bill, I'll offer the old saying, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Please recall that the goal of this effort, as the Senator mentioned, is to get to the root of the problem, the traffickers, the pimps, those who are responsible for ruining the lives of the victims and doing so for profit. This bill is a respectable and solid first step. As we've heard, the resources are already in place. Training for law enforcement on how to handle sex trafficking situations and access to service providers that can help the victims restore their lives. This bill is a very strong and necessary link between those two. It'll open the door to safety, aid, and freedom for Alaskan victims of sex trafficking. And as you, the members of this committee, you can know that you've taken part in the demise of sex trafficking in this state. Thank you.
Yeah. Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we do have online. Is it?
I think in the room we have some Department of Public Safety.
From people. Public Safety to talk about the training aspect.
All right. If, do we have a member of the Department of Public Safety who is here to come speak to it today? Okay. Kelly? Okay. Why don't you come on, okay. Kelly? Okay. Thank you. You can sit next to the Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Just put yourself on the record. And I think one of the questions was, can we let this go through your training, and what's the fiscal impact to you? So,
absolutely. Excuse me. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Public Safety, Special Assistant to Public Safety Commissioner Gary Folger. The Department of Public Safety currently does provide training on human trafficking and sex trafficking, both at its Public Safety Training Academy for new police recruits, as well as in regional trainings that we've been doing since FY 2013 for existing officers. The training covers not only the identification and investigation of sex trafficking crimes, but the understanding of the dynamics of the crime and how people become victims of the crime. Yeah. So we believe that the training that we currently have is adequate and certainly brings to light the differences between someone who is actively engaging in prostitution and someone who is a victim of sex trafficking.
So you would see this as just another descriptive element in your training?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So then I wouldn't expect that we would have a huge fiscal note on this. And that's going to be one of the issues we deal with this year, is how to continually make our world a better place without us costing more and more. And last year we did some significant work on sex trafficking, some of the legal issues revolving around that. So, and greatly appreciate what the Department of Public Safety. Is there any questions for Kelly? All right. We just wanted to get that clarified on the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator, first of all, thank you for doing this particular bill. I, for one, appreciate it. That's why I signed on with you on it. But it does seem to me that there is more work to do. Give me an expectation of, I guess for myself, I'm willing to think through some of those things. Is that something that you've already begun? Just give us an idea of things that we might see moving forward from here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Britta Gardner for Midtown Anchorage. I think there is a lot, and I think that the people who testified on the first hearing raised some very interesting questions. And one is that if somebody is charged with prostitution and they're listed on court view, that process happens even before they've had a chance to do the affirmative defense. And once you're listed, if you're looking for a job or something like that and people check court view, I believe that Senator Dyson has worked on that problem.
Yeah, that's in progress.
Yes, it's in progress. If that doesn't go through, I think we should try again and make that happen, because I think they have a very good case. And then there's the question of people who have maybe a history from 5-10 years ago before this law is in effect, and is there reason to do retroactive expungement of that record? You know, I'm not expert on the issues involved in that, but I think it's something that's worth exploring. So those are the two big things that I'm looking for, and I'm open to other suggestions too.
And I think as a committee, this is not the last time we'll talk about this. So
thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, excuse me, there is another issue, and there are a series of crimes that are associated with trafficking where somebody who is drawn in or coerced into prostitution might also be coerced into shoplifting, using and selling drugs, those kind of things. I think it's, you know, the further back you go and the broader you spread the net, the harder it is to assure ourselves which actions are the result of trafficking and which are not. But I think it's something to look at and look at data on.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. And Senator Gardner, hit on something important. Basically, in our law, we call pimps traffickers. And trafficking under our law does not imply that you transported someone, you know, Manac stuff at all. So that might be a little bit of confusion. I know you didn't mean it when you say bad guys. The worst pimps I've known in Anchorage were women, you know, and you were using it in a non-gender sensitive way, right?
Exactly.
I understood that. I hope you can say on the record that when we say induced, that includes getting them hooked on drugs, not only threats of being deported, but threats against family members, you know, building dependency and so on, that's part of what means to be induced.
Through the chair, I think that's exactly right. I recognize that there are some people who may choose of their own volition to be involved in commercial sex trade. Those are not the people that this bill addresses. We're talking about people who were induced in a variety of ways and where somebody else benefits.
Yeah. I made my statement or question awkwardly. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that the inducement wasn't necessarily what's the word you use? But it included getting them hooked on drugs and so on. So the pimp has, you say induced or caused to engage it. And I would want you to say on the record that getting somebody hooked on drugs in order to get them to work in the sex trade is a part of what induced means.
Through the chair, it is my understanding that very often that is the case, but where somebody is intentionally, knowingly addicted, and then that addiction is used as a way of controlling their behavior in a host of ways, including prostituting them.
But I want you to say that it is your intention that for the surface of this law, it is a positive defense that the pimp got me hooked.
I believe that is the case. Yes, it is my intention.
That is your intention, and all kinds of coercion, you know, and so on, that, yeah, colors the fact that it makes the case the person wasn't doing it of their own free will, or that their own free will was greatly impaired.
Yes, that's accurate.
You can say, that's exactly what I intended.
That is my intention, exactly. Thank you.
And he's pushy, but got it out of you. And really, what we're trying to do is make an affirmative defense at this point. And it is tough. And for the testimony I heard, this is tough because you have to face into really kind of an unfriendly crowd to do this. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to that. But I don't know that we're going to find a solution without adding a whole bunch of other stuff to this bill. So any last comments before I ask the committee what they want to do with this thing?
Thank you very much, and thank you for hearing it twice. I think, as we've said, this is the start of something that could take us down a path, and I think it's also a way to gather more information to better understand how we can address the problem that exists in many levels in our society and where people are made vulnerable. So thank you.
Thank you very much. What's the will of the committee at this point, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we pass out from committee, or move committee Senate Bill 170. That's the backslash U version that I have before me, and with whatever fiscal note there is. Zero fiscal note. And individual recommendations that I hope are all due pass.
Is there any objection to moving this bill on to the next committee referral? All right.
Thank you
that
very much.
We'll move Senate Bill 170 from committee with individual recommendations. Take a brief at ease. Record. So thank you very much for the help on that last bill, 170. Now we go to 176, which is the relating to the regulation of firearms knives by the University of Alaska. And I left the public testimony open, and last time I left a couple of people just sitting. And I committed to them that I would make sure that we left them plenty of time to testify. And so we have two in front of us who are Juno UAS students, and I wanted them to have a chance to put themselves on the record with regard to this particular bill. And so I'm not going to run your time real tight, but unless you start misusing the time. So introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Jarmin Kramlich, and I'm the UAS student body president. I've been speaking with students on my campus regarding their opinions that they hold on people's ability to carry concealed weapons on university property. Students on the Juneau campus feel that the legislation being proposed in the Alaska State Senate will have unintended consequences that will interfere with the main institutional purpose of the University of Alaska. Overall, students on the Juneau campus did not support the legislation. Students seem to share some common core themes on why they were opposed to this piece of legislation. Students were concerned for their safety, and they did not feel comfortable in their fellow students' ability to safely and effectively carry a concealed weapon on university property. Some students said that if the legislation were to go on and pass, then it would make them feel uneasy. The mission of the University of Alaska Southeast is student learning enhanced by faculty scholarship, undergraduate research, and creative activities, community engagement, and the cultures and environment of Southeast Alaska. Students felt that people's ability to carry a concealed weapon on campus did not fit well with that mission statement. Students felt strongly that allowing a concealed weapon on campus would only distract from the main institutional purpose of the university, which is student learning. Another common concern that students had with this piece of legislation was their fear that the Alaska State Legislature would be interfering with the Board of Regents' ability to enact policies that it found were in the best interest of the students, staff, and faculty, and the thousands of visitors that come to the university each day. The people of Alaska have entrusted the Board of Regents to be the guardians of the university, and any piece of legislation that would jeopardize student safety, distract from student learning, or would otherwise interfere with the Regents' ability to adopt policies that were in the best interest of student safety and learning, then the USUA SJC will oppose that piece of legislation, as we have done in the case of Senate Bill 176. And we urge you to do the same. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you, and thank you for your public service.
Chairman, thank you very much. And normally I let Lady go first, but I just went right to him, so my apologies. So we have next, Jessica.
Jessica Dominey, you hit the sock. And thank you so much for allowing me to speak in front of you today. My English name is Jessica Dominey. I serve as the UAS Student Government Vice President. I, too, have had a chance to speak with our students. Most of the students that I've actually had the chance to speak with are some of our students who are dual-enrolled students, high school students, who are taking courses at the university right now. I've had a chance to talk with them, had a chance to talk with their parents to find out where they stand and what they think about the opportunities of our students to be in a classroom where there will be guns present if this law should pass. Most of the high school students that I spoke with come from small villages. Most of them are around firearms a lot. They themselves don't have a problem with it, because they respect the power that comes with those weapons. They understand the purposes of these weapons are for subsistence use, for hunting, gathering, and for protection. They themselves don't understand what the purpose would be to have guns in a classroom or on a campus. I happen to agree with my fellow students on this matter. It is a distracting idea to think that even though this person has gone through all the required training to be able to hold a concealed firearm, there is nothing that says that they would be able to control that weapon if someone else were to take a hold of that weapon. Our high school students and their parents worry and they fear if this law should pass, what would happen to these high school students, along with our middle school and elementary students that do visit our campus quite frequently? On our campus right now, we actually have different events going on during our spring break, where some of our elementary and our middle school students are actually getting a tour of the college, seeing themselves on a college campus. I ask for the support for the students to keep the university a weapon-free zone. This fits with our university's mission statement. It is our role as students to be able to have a safe environment to be able to learn in. Thank you so very much for allowing me to speak, and thank you very much for your service.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming. Senator Dyson has a question.
I'm going to smile, and these are not pejorative questions, and I don't mean to sound like a lecturing professor, but under our form of government, one of the primary things is to protect rights, and our law is pretty clear that you should only restrict Bill of Rights, civil liberties, when there's a compelling public interest to do so. So the question from my perspective is, if indeed we're going to restrict Second Amendment rights, is there an overwhelming, compelling reason to do so? And I assume that because you all think that the Regents has the right to limit Second Amendment rights, you must automatically think it's okay if they restrict First Amendment, freedom of speech and religion, Fourth Amendment, privacy, due process, and so on and so forth. Everything you said about your understanding of the will of the student body had to do with their feelings. You know, and would they feel the same way that their feelings should govern the restriction of rights, particularly freedom of speech? You know, what if somebody said, you can't use your first or second language, or you can't speak about something that makes other people uncomfortable? Talk about people being uncomfortable with firearms being present. What if it was uncomfortable with somebody who had a very different political or cultural view or said things that were uncomfortable? I'd love you to read my email the last 2 days. There's lots of things, and the disgusting thing about my critics is how often they're right, but they make me very uncomfortable, and they choose some vocabulary that I...
And Senator Dyson, I'm going to cut in here only because I've got 6 more people to testify.
All right, and can they answer?
Go ahead. Whichever one of you wants to speak up to that, I'm game. And it looks like we're getting more public testimony as we speak, which I really have to keep limited.
I guess the answer like that I would give is I think the main issue is when I talk with the students on my campus, the main thing that they're concerned with is they just don't feel that concealed weapons have any place in the classroom. I mean, they think it should be about the learning and whatnot. And I that's just the answer that I've gotten from the students that I speak with.
Greatly appreciate you two taking the time to come. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think obviously you got the attention of the senator here, so greatly appreciate that very much. I'm going to go to some online testimony at this point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Russell, is it Russell Kell or Russell Kelly? Kell? Sorry. Russell, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, please?
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. The state constitution is clear. The federal constitution is clear, yet the university says no. Veterans have bled and risked their lives to defend the constitution and the rights the constitution protects. Yet the university says no. And veterans are stripped of rights when they step onto university property. The question isn't whether you feel safe. The question is, are you safe? All legitimate evidence indicates you are safest when you are able to defend yourself. I support SB 176. The question I have is, why would millions of dollars of taxpayer money be provided to an institution that with unfettered arrogance and unrestrained arrogance ignores the constitutional rights of the citizens and the taxpayers, and ignores the highest secular law?
Russell, thank you very much for I'm sorry, you paused. I jumped in, sorry.
Okay. The university's example, by the university's bad example, our children are taught it's okay to ignore the rights of others. By the university's example, okay, they don't correct the problem. They make a problem worse because people think it's our right to violate and to ignore the law. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
greatly
much.
Appreciate you taking the time to call in. We go next to Palmer, Mike Coons. If you can keep it brief, Mike, because you've testified once already.
Yes, sir. I want to try and keep this as short as sweet as I can. My name is Mike Coons from Palmer, and I am speaking for myself. I agree with President Gamble yesterday that this isn't about compromise. This is about principle of inalienable rights. I fully oppose the CS, especially the first couple sections. And the bottom line of all this is that the adults on campus, specifically 21 and older, are presently being treated as third-class citizens by being denied the right to keep and bear arms. This CS elevates them to second class by requiring the adult to ask permission of the state of Alaska to carry a firearm so as to placate the president and the Board of Regents of University of Alaska over their unfounded fear of the armed citizen. Further, I ask the question to Hans, what would be the result if this were to be passed and I came on campus carrying concealed for whatever lawful purpose, since I carry without a permit as per Alaska State statutes now. I was told that if somebody figured out concealed means concealed, that I was carrying, that I would be required to leave. So I am a lawful carrying concealed without a permit outside the line of UA, but unlawful when I cross the line. Understand, I am a 61-year-old adult, adult being the operative word. As the last section on safes, fully concur. It's just plain good sense, and I would bet my retirement pay that the vast majority of firearms owners would do this voluntarily so the firearm is not stolen more than any other reason. Lastly, a person from the Coalition of Student Leaders testified on Monday that she was concerned about a disgruntled student possibly being armed during a conversation with staff, and that the staff would be worried and not on a level playing field. Easy answer. Nothing is stopping the staff from being armed, trained, understanding good situational awareness, and thus having a level playing field.
Yeah, Mike, I'm going to ask you to wrap up, Mike.
Yeah,
only because I've got others to testify.
I understand. Federal statistics, 11% wrongful shoot by the police, less than 2% by the citizens. Additionally, the president stated that students would be leaving the campus of this past. I'm sorry, if that's what they feel, then they can leave, because they obviously do not trust Alaskans and Americans. Do not accept the CS and pass the original bill as written. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike Coons, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm sorry to have to cut you short, but you did testify once before, and so Robert Clift is in Anchorage. Robert, put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Okay, my name's Robert Clift. I'm testifying for myself. I'm in support of 176. I'm a former school administrator from the Bush. I spent 20 years out there. And I thought I'd speak to the policy, because I heard that General Campbell is pleased with the policy he has. And I thought it might be good to tell you what the policy is. They say it's a gun-free zone, but in actual fact, it's not. They have no way to, there's nothing illegal about carrying on campus. If they know you're carrying, they simply ask you to leave, and if you don't, well then, they'll charge you with trespass. That's all. So all the people who say they're uncomfortable with people being armed on campus need to understand they're already on campus with people who are armed. I go through there all the time, and I'm armed. And the only people who are being, have their rights denied are people who are employed by the university and could have an unfavorable employment review if they find out they're carrying, or students who can be expelled. So, I don't know. This doesn't seem like a good idea to me. It sounds like what you've actually got going on is a arbitrary and capricious situation where I'm sure administrative bureaucrats think this is great because they can apply it as they see fit and not apply it when it's to their benefit. So I'd encourage you to go ahead and pass this, and I wonder, you know, I was a Army officer, and I remember taking an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and I'm wondering what a general officer is doing when he clearly violates the Second Amendment of the Constitution. All I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Clift. I greatly appreciate you taking your time, and good comments. So thank you very much. And to keep things moving, I'm going to go to Michael Chambers in Anchorage.
Thank you. Yes. For the record, my name is Michael Chambers. I'm the chair of the Alaska Libertarian Party, and in this capacity, I'm the unitary voice of approximately 9,000 registered libertarians who the vast majority support SB 176 without adding any amendments for permits. We recognize the right of to bear arms as a fundamental right of all citizens. We do not read in the Constitution, in the Second Amendment, and consider that it implies there's an addendum
for exemptions given to bureaucrats who have jurisdiction over geographic areas of the state. This is not a matter of conveying constitutional rights when and where in areas of public domain. It is a fundamental right. I thank you very much for your consideration and for your service. Thank you.
Mr. Chambers, thank you very much. Clear, concise, and to the point. Thank you very much. Barbara Struble, also in Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much, and thank you, Senator Coghill, for introducing Senate Bill 176. I have been on the campus. I've talked to the students. I've taken lots of courses there. And as a great-grandmother, I believe in the Second Amendment and the rights, and every student that I've talked to says, yes, why should we not have the same rights as every other citizen? And so I support the four gentlemen that spoke before me, and please pass Senate Bill 176 in its original form. Thank you very much.
Barbara, thank you very much for taking your time to be in our committee. Greatly appreciated. And once again, sharp and to the point, very well said. Mark Fish is in Big Lake. Big Lake, can you hear
me,
Mark?
Yes, this is I'm Mark Fish. I'm representing myself. And I, too, am here to speak in favor of the original form of this Senate Bill 176. As a former president of Airport Heights Community Council, who often used the Chester Creek bike trail system, and found myself going to my mother's house via bicycle on trails that intersect the university, I was often in a quandary. Do I leave myself and my wife or anybody that I may come up upon who is under attack, which has happened on that trail in multiple instances? Do I leave them defenseless because the university says I have to keep my gun outside of their jurisdiction? I want to remind the students and the employees of the university that it is not only their university. This is a public university, and these are public lands, and used by the public. We've had professors die from moose attacks. And we've had, there's a certain section of that trail at one time was known as Ray Valley, so much so that they put up buttons on the trail that they can be pushed for emergency panic buttons to notify campus police. Unfortunately, they found out that system failed on multiple times to retrieve any response from security. So if you cannot provide security for the people on campus, you must allow for the people on campus to provide for their own. Otherwise, I think there's a great liability to the university if they don't. And with that, I'll close and not waste any more of your time other than to say I agree with the testimony that has given in the past in favor of this original form of this legislation. Thank you very much.
Mark, and you are not wasting our time. None of the public testimony has wasted our time. We have tried to listen intently and be very alert to people's varying different opinions. So thank you. And for all those on public testimony, and what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to close the public testimony. We have, I think, heard the various different sides of it, and I'm going to ask my staff members to come forward at this time. And I think at this point what I did was, and I can ask the record keeper, I think when we brought the Y version before us, I objected, and I have not removed my objection. And I'm going to explain that I am going to remove my objection so that we can have the Y version before us, which I now am doing. And I think the reason I'm willing to go forward with this, and even against some of the testimony I heard today, is that what we tried to do is we tried to get a good standard for why to move forward. If there is a fundamental right, to restrict that fundamental right has to have a very compelling reason. And the way we understand it has to be under some strict scrutiny. And I'm talking way beyond my knowledge here, but in what I've learned is we have to do it in the least restrictive ways. So I've tried to keep those before us as we move forward here. Requiring a permit is restrictive, but it may very well be the least restrictive, considering that we have students who will be underage here. And I think maybe I should have Hans, who has started this discussion, and have Chad explain to me in the last few minutes. I wanted to allow some time for debate, so very briefly, we've looked at that. Any comments, Hans, and then I'll go to Chad. Put yourself on the record, Hans.
Okay, for the record, Hans Rodvik, intern to Senator Coghill. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you again for having me before you here today to discuss Senate Bill 176. I guess given time constraints, I won't be able to address as many as the points that have been brought against this bill as I originally intended, but I'll maybe just touch on a couple of the main ones. I think one of the big concerns that we've heard for the Board of Regents policy to remain as their policy is that there's a presence of K through 12 students on campus. I think this really needs to be put to rest once and for all, because these students, these regular Alaskans who are between the ages of, you know, 4 or 5 and up to 18, are already surrounded by adults who are concealed carrying throughout the rest of the state. The state does not prohibit concealed carry by law-abiding adults where K through 12 students live, travel, and visit on school-sanctioned field trips. Following the university's logic, the state should prohibit the carrying of concealed firearms from all places where these school-aged children might happen to be. This would include malls, movie theaters, grocery stores, toy stores, restaurants, bikes, you know, bike trails, and the parks. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, every day school-aged children are surrounded by these lawful adults in Alaska who are already carrying concealed. So I just think this needs to be kind of settled once and for all. Another one of the concerns that we've heard a lot about is that if this bill goes forward, the university would be rendered basically defenseless to protect the campus. This is in no way truth. Every current law on the books regulating criminal activity will stand. Harassment statutes stand, criminal or assaults will stand, all the disorderly conduct statutes stand. All we're saying here with Senate Bill 176 is that law-abiding adults who go through the rigorous process of getting a permit will be able to defend themselves from criminal behavior. Like one of the public members said, there, in the same year the university implemented their policy banning firearms, a individual was stomped to death by a moose on campus. Had this policy not been in effect, it might have been a little different story with this man possibly living if an armed citizen had been there. Also, like some of the members of the public have said, that it currently is nowhere in statute a crime to carry on campus. It really boils down to a clerical change here with Senate Bill 176, where we're simply codifying the current practice that's already going on. Firearms are being carried concealed, and what we're doing is ensuring that these lawful citizens aren't going to face administrative penalties or be removed from campus by exercising their fundamental rights. Another one of the points that this committee's heard is that the bill and the presence of concealed firearms on campus would distract from the learning environment. Well, I'd like this committee to think about, when was the last time you or any of your colleagues have seen a individual carrying a concealed firearm? The word concealed is there for a reason. Concealed handguns on campus would not distract college students or members of the public any more than concealed carry would in restaurants, malls, movie theaters, and the things along that line. One of the other, obviously, college campuses, there is a presence of drugs and alcohol that people use and abuse and violate criminal law by doing that underage. However, some of the studies that I've seen show that most camping occurs off campus to begin with, that most binge drinking occurs between the ages of 18 and 23, which is important to point out because the average age at the three main campuses of the university range between the ages of 28 and 30. And as you already know, it's a crime to carry a concealed handgun under the ages of 21. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what we have here before us with Senate Bill 176 is a proper balance between the public safety interest of the university and the two fundamental rights that are incorporated with concealed carry. That is, the right to keep and bear arms and the right to privacy that are enshrined in our state constitution. We think, and the data has showed for roughly two decades, that lawful adults who go through this rigorous process to obtain a concealed handgun permit will, number one, remain law-abiding, number two, not turn into mental cases or deranged individuals when they walk onto our state campuses, number three, will be properly suited to defend themselves and others in the case of an actor-shooter scenario, and lastly, they will not distract from the learning environment, for this has not occurred throughout the rest of the state where lawful concealed carry has been going on for the past 20 years. With that, I'll turn it over to Chad.
Thank you, Hans. And Chad, any last words?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchison. I'll keep it brief so we can have a debate on it. This comes down to what we believe is the least restrictive alternative. That's why you see the CS before you. There is a very deliberative process as it relates to balancing the compelling interest of public safety versus the individual rights that are brought up when you're talking about concealed carry, the right to bear arms, and the right to privacy. We believe that the CS is a very fair balance of all of those elements, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and we've had that discussion a number of times. This is its first committee referral. It may not make it through the legislature, but I think it was our responsibility to make sure we actually heard from all concerned and tried to make as deliberative as I can. So is there any questions for any of those who are proposing the bill? So I'd like to have a motion so we could have a debate.
What's the version?
Why?
Right. Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept as our working document the committee substitute for SB 176, the Y version.
And I'll object for anybody wants to have debate, comment at this point. I think we've gone through very extensive public testimony. I think I've tried to get the legal principle as laid out as cleanly as I could. I know it does have a fiscal note, so it's going to go up to the Finance Committee. Then I think at that point it's probably going to be the time for the legislature and the university to figure out what that is, what kind of a fiscal impact that really is going to have, and I'll leave that for their discussion. But I felt it was very important for us to at least hammer out what I thought was a better legal principle than we've started off with. So is there any other comment? Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I wish that we had done a better job of defining what a lockbox is, and that we had allowed that person who had the permit would have been able to have long guns on campus. But I won't hold the build up for that.
Yep.
Point well taken. Motion?
The motion is made, and I've objected so we can have the discussion. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote to move the bill out of committee, move it forward, and I'll just point to I know there's a lot of concern about what will happen, and I would just point people to the experiences in Utah and Colorado. Utah has 32,000 students. They've allowed concealed weapons there for about 4 years. They've had no incidents. Colorado has 30,000 students. Concealed weapons have been permitted since 2011. There's been, according to their head of their campus police, neither an increase or decrease in any measure. And out of that 30,000 students, they only have about 150 that actually take advantage of it. It's a delicate balance. I'm willing to let the bill go forward, Mr. President. I think there's some strong constitutional issues here. Changing it to concealed, I think, was a a big change, and I'm going to support the bill moving out of committee.
Mr. President, it has a good sound to it. I won't get carried away with that. If there was a discussion, I'm going to remove my objection. Any further objection to moving Senate Bill 176 from committee with individual recommendations and attached list notes? Hearing no objection, we'll move 176 from committee with individual recommendations, a task fiscal note. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks, everybody, for testifying. Greatly appreciate it. Stay here so that we can sign up the paperwork. We're adjourned.